brand new series. We did a medical ethics series in June a few years ago, but that was a different set of topics and different focus. So welcome to Jewish Bioethics. Those who registered online, special thank you to you. That helped clear things up for this morning. I don't have Betty this morning to manage everything. She did warn me, so to be fair, I knew. But God willing, she'll be back next week to help with it. If anybody needs to register at the end or to take care of paying at the end, I'll stick around for a few minutes for that. I did print out 40 source sheets because there were about 28, 29 people registered. Clearly, we are over the 40 mark at this point. I don't know, but it looks like there are some sheets still on the back table. So either I printed more than I expected or not everybody took, or some people printed off of the one that I emailed. Either way, I hope that you have the sheets, but I will, as always, send out a follow-up email from the class and include a digital version of the source sheets there, I expect. If anyone has a phone that is... thank you. Please make sure to turn it to vibrate, turn it to silent. So, our topic for this morning is a difficult one. Difficult technically, in terms of just the information we have to cover, but also a difficult topic for people emotionally. The topic is abortion. And I want to be very clear that even though it's true, I like to sort of make jokes as we go along and the like, nothing I say should be taken in any way as being glib about the topic. I recognize full well the seriousness of it, and also nothing that I say one way or the other should be taken in any way as judging or giving halachic guidance on the issue. If anyone has a practical issue, they should please seek advice from a combination of medical personnel as well as a competent rabbi. What I want to show in the course of our 4 weeks of discussing Jewish bioethics are the basic steps that are involved in approaching any issue in Jewish bioethics. So I designed it as being from birth to death. We're going to be starting, as you see, from abortion and working our way all the way to medical assistance in dying with a couple of stops along the way. I think the other topics are cosmetic surgery and medical costs and charging for health care. But the methods that are used in resolving issues from a Jewish perspective are really common to all of the topics that we're going to see. Our first step is that we look at biblical text. We look for basic laws. We look for ethical ideas. And that's really, that has to be the starting point for any approach to a topic in Jewish law. Then we look at the opposing rabbinical sides on the issues that are involved, as well as ways of resolving the tension between the different positions. Then you look at the case at hand, because the case at hand always will have elements that are unique and that require that they be addressed. It isn't enough to say, well, broadly, here's the rule. You need to be able to talk about issues that are specific to the case at hand. And that's how you resolve it. So, example. We're dealing with abortion as our opening topic. What sort of biblical text might one look at in order to approach this topic? I mean, there's one that's a gimme. There's one that I would expect people to get. Well, bear fruit and multiply is one. Yeah. Sorry.
Talking about Sarah having a baby at 120.
No. Nope. She. Yeah, no. The. She. Had a baby, but she was 90. So let's not exaggerate. But no, I'm not talking stories. I'm not talking about stories. I'm about laws. Give me a law that bears that has application here. There is a law in the Torah, yeah?
I'm not sure, but something about somebody pursues you. You are allowed to
That is true. That's going to become relevant. The law of the pursuer. In the event that party A is out to harm party B, so party B is justified in doing what is necessary to save his, her life, and that comes up when you're dealing with issues where the pregnancy endangers the health of the mother. Do you view the fetus as a threat to the mother's life? So that will be an example. I was going to say,
just general broad brush stroke, do not kill in the Ten Commandments, defined as murdering.
Right, do not murder, right? That's got to be part of the calculation. Whether this is called murder or not, that has to be weighed. That was the one I was kind of expecting would be quoted first. But those are some of the examples of biblical text. And then you get the different sides rabbinically on this, which we're going to walk through, and then we'll look at some of the issues that are relevant for particular cases. So one of the examples that we'll deal with is the case in which it is known that the fetus has some kind of ailment such that the fetus can't live more than a couple of years. The classic case is Tay-Sachs. So they're able to diagnose and they know what they're dealing with. Does that change the law regarding pursuing an abortion? What's interesting to me in particular when we approach this and every bioethics topic is that even though philosophical discussions are relevant in terms of understanding the halakha, in terms of understanding the law, they don't drive the law. So, for example, there's a classic debate which makes it into the Talmud about what's called ensoulment. Okay, what does ensoulment mean? E-N-S-O-U-L-M-E-N-T. Ensoulment. No? So, ensoulment is the term for when the soul enters the body. That's the term. And there's a classic historic debate as to when the soul enters the body. Is it at conception? Is it later? The Catholic Church had a lot of fun with this topic. But the topic shows up in the Talmud as well. One might expect that you would start there with your question of whether abortion is allowed or not allowed because the soul should matter. Nonetheless, that's not the way it works in Jewish law. That is used as a way to explain some of the law that's on the books. However, it's not used as a driver of the law that's on the books. Philosophical discussions are very interesting, but they tend not to drive the law. If you take a look on your sheets at the first source, this is from a rabbi in Israel today, Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, in his work, Pnei Halakha. And he talks about how one approaches abortion issues in terms of giving halachic guidance, giving guidance from the Jewish law perspective. Even when the couple has decided to follow the view permitting abortion in a particular case, I should actually pause there for a moment because that may be a novelty for some people. I'm not sure how much everybody's familiar with this topic, but Judaism is not the Catholic Church. That's not news. However, my point is that it's very funny. There's a summer program that goes on at U of T. It's called IPEM, International Pediatric Emergency Medicine Elective, in which they bring pediatric emergency medicine residents from around the Middle East. So they bring Israelis, they bring Jordanians, they bring Palestinians, and they bring Canadians. And all together participate in this program. And it used to be, it didn't happen this past summer, but in previous summers, they would bring representatives of different religions to speak on bioethics from their cultural perspective. So I would go and speak from a Jewish perspective. And on the panel, you had a Buddhist, a Jain, an Anglican, a Catholic, and a Muslim. And me, and yet no jokes were told. But the Catholic, it was very interesting the way he changed because he was a spokesman. I'm blanking on his name right now. His first name is Tom. I'm forgetting his last name. But he is the spokesman of the Pope in English-speaking countries. So that's a pretty big swath, obviously. But I remember vividly that when Benedict was the Pope, he would say certain things, and then it changed when Francis became the Pope. He's just the spokesman, so he would say whatever it was. But when Benedict was the Pope, and questions were asked about issues like this, his response would always begin, year after year, with, yes, I know the way you think of us, we are the Church of No. Whatever the topic was, abortion, birth control, you name it. Judaism is not, so to speak, the synagogue of No. the position on abortion and on many other issues is a very nuanced position. It's not a flat out one way or the other. And I'm reminded of that when you read the opening line here of Rabbi Melamed's point in source number one. Even when the couple has decided to follow the view permitting abortion, it will be appropriate for them to take counsel with a rabbi who deals with these issues. And as has been stated, they may choose a rabbi whose inclination is to be lenient in these matters, knowing that the rabbi is lenient. First, why are you consulting the rabbi? To verify that the medical opinion is trustworthy. That's a really important point. Even though it sounds perhaps a little bit surprising, well, why wouldn't the doctor be trustworthy? The response to that is sometimes the doctor says, I understand medicine, and the medical positions here are very clear to me and need to be honored. The religion thing is superstition, and therefore I'm going to downplay the significance of it when I make my calculation and make my recommendation. So you have to know that the physician you're consulting is taking seriously the religious concerns that you have. And that's his first point. But second, because one cannot be lenient without responsible weighing of the issue. For the law is established based on many factors, such as fetal age, right, how far along in the pregnancy you are, the type of illness, the form of abortion, the quality of the test, and the family situation. Further, the decision regarding abortion is very difficult in hidden ways for the couple, and taking counsel with a trained rabbi will ease these hidden issues and guide them on a good path to continue building their family. So, in other words, this has to be something that is addressed not by someone fresh out of rabbinical school, and not by somebody who never deals with these issues. You need specialists. You need people who can actually speak to this with experience in the field and a great deal of sensitivity. There is room for some flexibility in it. I brought you source number two, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, in an article called Abortion, a Halachic Perspective. He says, the reader has surely discerned that in a number of places I have refrained from setting down definitive conclusions, but have been satisfied to indicate general principles, tendencies, and possibilities in the halacha. This approach is not merely the product of modesty or hesitation in resolving debates among halachic titans. It is rooted in a view of the nature of psak. Psak means halachic decisions. So this is about the nature of issuing decisions in general, and regarding this topic specifically. These are areas where, on the one hand, the halachic details are not clearly fleshed out in the Talmud and Rishonim, the early authorities, and on the other hand, the personal circumstances are often complex and perplexing. In such areas, there is room and, in my opinion, an obligation for a measure of flexibility. A sensitive posek, halachic authority, recognizes both the gravity of the personal situation and the seriousness of the halachic factors. This approach is neither evasive nor discriminatory. The flexibility arises from a recognition that halachic rulings are not and should not be the output of human microcomputers, but of thinking human beings. A recognition that these rulings must be applied to concrete situations with a bold effort to achieve the optimal moral and halachic balance among the various factors. Thus, it is the case that halachic rulings have more of the character of general directives than specific decisive rulings, within set limits, of course. And when the posek is not absolutely convinced respecting the point at issue. So there is room for different opinions on a particular case. There are factors that have to be weighed very carefully given the situation at hand. And therefore, he says he's going to be careful in his article not to say this is the way it is, because he can't. It's not a responsible way to approach the issue. Susan, you've been very patient.
Friend of mine's child had to have an abortion, a legal one. It was 5.5 months, and the fetus had no brain. And so she could not pick her rabbi. The way it worked at Mount Sinai was, you're allowed to pick a religious leader, but they pick the leader, not you.
So that's interesting. I don't know how this works.
I
hear what you're saying. That's very interesting. That's not something I would endorse.
But there's a possibility that it could be meeting this
point, then he's a knowledgeable rabbi.
So what I'm going to say is the following. What I'm going to say is the following. Two things that are going to be really important in the course of this. First of all, that I don't know Mount Sinai well enough to know why or what their procedures are. But more to the point, I'm going to ask in general if we could actually avoid the personal cases. Not that they're not important, but they can wait till afterwards, email follow-up after the class, whatever it is, because there's a lot of material we have to get through. If you can't pick the rabbi, you have a problem. That would be my answer, right. I'm also not going to bring every possible source and every possible issue in this conversation because there is way more material than you're going to cover in 60 minutes. But I gave you three links, which may be of interest. Source number three, these are classes that I've delivered to medical crowds, to doctors, nurses, other medical professionals, on topics that relate here. The first one being the question of genetic screening, as well as aborting before implantation in the case of IVF. The second one is an abortion-related topic, whether a pregnant woman is allowed to pursue chemotherapy that might be harmful for the fetus. And then third is the issue of aiding an abortion, acting as a medical professional on a particular procedure. So those are all topics which, again, you can catch the audio recordings there online. The source sheets are there as well, and we'll add to our understanding of the issue. But let's get into the issue at hand. I have certain cases that I want to discuss, but I think we need to launch into this or we won't get anywhere. So first of all, phase one, biblical text. And it is certainly true that we have prohibitions against murder. One example of it, source number four, the text says, one who strikes an ish, makei ish, is the term in the Torah. I didn't translate the word ish for a reason that will be clear in a moment. One who strikes an ish, who then dies, will be put to death. Capital punishment. Capital punishment is a fun discussion for another time. We're not going through the discussion now of how it was implemented, why it's there, and all the nuances of capital punishment. Topic for another time. But one who strikes an ish, and the ish dies, is put to death. The question is, what does ish mean? Literally, the word ish means man. Do you think this means man and not woman? No, it is male and female alike. What might be excluded, though? What could you think to exclude? Well, since our topic is abortion, right? Fetus would be a question. Does this in fact include a fetus? Or does ish refer to somebody who is already post-utero? Maybe it only refers to an adult. Maybe it doesn't refer to a minor. Ish is often used biblically to refer to somebody who is already an adult. We tend not to use this word with a child. So maybe it only means an adult. You have to be careful and pay attention to language on things like this. Now, if that were my only source for skepticism about the status of a child, of a fetus, I should say, then I'd say, it's a nice thing to think about, but it doesn't really hold water. But take a look at source number five. Because number five is where things really get going. Take a look there. When men fight, and they strike a pregnant woman, and her children emerge, and what it means by emerge is she's pregnant and she loses the pregnancy. That's what it's talking about. But there is no death for her, meaning she didn't die. She lost the pregnancy, but she survives. He, the man who struck her, shall be punished as established upon him by the woman's husband, and he shall pay it in court. And if there is death, if she dies, then it's a life for a life. So, the penalty for him striking her and she loses the pregnancy is
a fine.
Right, restitution of some kind. Determined by, people always love this, the husband. Right, why is it determined by the husband? Why not by her? Because you have to keep in mind, you're talking about the status of his child, for whom he is financially responsible, meaning he's the one on the hook. he has a responsibility to look after all of the financial needs of this child until the child graduates graduate school, or somewhere around there. She is not on the hook. He is the one who is financially on the hook, and therefore the child, this fetus, is in fact viewed as his ward and his responsibility, and therefore he is the one who will dictate, even though she's the one who lost the pregnancy and suffered in that regard, and there will be damages paid to her for whatever pain and suffering she goes through. That's a completely separate calculation. But when it comes to the value of the fetus, so to speak, that's done through the father. Elaine?
What if it's the husband who does the striking?
Sorry?
What if it's the husband who causes the miscarriage?
Then he's not going to have to pay, because he'll be paying himself. He will still have to pay for whatever he caused to his wife. That's still going to be true. A husband is not allowed to harm his wife. We're very clear about that on the law, on the books. But no, he's not going to pay to himself, and there's no heir to the fetus, so to speak. So that's all you have.
It's an additional punishment because of...
No. There's nothing else to do. I mean, he gets the punishment he gets for harming his wife, and there's no one to pay in terms of what he did to the fetus.
But is he deciding, is there a law?
Right, so that's a longer piece to this, is how exactly are you evaluating this? This seems very odd. This sounds like a civil lawsuit in which he's going to bring them to court and say, well, I suffered this element of damage. So I'm going to defer on that, because it's a more complicated question about how jurisprudence works overall in cases of damages and who determines what the damage is. So I'm going to hold that. There was another question over here. I thought it's hard to always see all the hands. Okay, so what we have in source number 5 is a text which says that the penalty for killing a fetus is fundamentally financial. That's what it is. It's not what we saw in source number 4, which is to be put to death. So from this we deduce what? It's not called a full-blown life. Even though I mentioned in the beginning ensoulment, this debate about when the soul enters the body, the conclusion Talmudically is the soul is there from the beginning. Nonetheless, having a soul doesn't mean you are a full-blown life. That's really the result of this. The fact that there is a soul, and I'm aware that this is where the Catholic Church goes its own way, but that's okay, we're not beholden to them. The statement here is that even though one is not allowed to do this, it is not called murder. And if you take a look at source number 6, you see a very clear presentation of this. This is talking about the case in which a woman is having trouble giving birth, and to the point where it's actually medically considered a threat to her life. So take a look at source number 6, please. Maimonides codifies this. He's only pulling a law out of the Talmud, but his presentation of it is more concise than the Talmudic one. The Torah prohibits having mercy for the life of a pursuer. If someone is trying to kill somebody else, you can't have mercy and say, well, I don't want to harm him. That doesn't work that way. Therefore, the sages ruled that one may cut the fetus inside a woman who is having difficulty giving birth, whether through medicine or by hand, whatever your means are of aborting the fetus, as though he was pursuing her to kill her. Once he produces his head, we don't touch him. For we do not push off one life for another. This is nature. That's a separate, his last, but we may come back to the point about once the fetus has already emerged, so that now it's one life versus another life. That's its own discussion, which we may come back to. But the point in the beginning of it is the point that's directly relevant right now. The statement is that that if the fetus endangers the mother, then you are allowed to, and in fact required to, abort the fetus. The implication is, if not for that, if not for the threat it poses to the mother, I would not be allowed to do something to abort the fetus. So it's very clear that there is a prohibition. What do we know right now? Right now we know there's a general prohibition against murder. That was what we started with. We also know that the biblical text says that the penalty for killing a fetus is not death, it is financial. And we have this source in Maimonides, which codifies an idea that appears, again, 2,000 years ago in the Talmud, which states that if the fetus is a threat to the mother, then you abort the fetus, implying that otherwise you're not allowed to abort the fetus. There is a basic prohibition against doing so. So this gives us some of the basics coming in. Now, we need to get more complicated. And we get more complicated by looking at rabbinic sources on both sides of the issue. Our fundamental question is the fetus a full life or not? Go ahead.
If in a difficult pregnancy, both the life of the fetus and the mother are threatened, which one do you say?
If in the case of, say this again, in the case of a difficult pregnancy,
the life of the mother and the child.
Right.
Which one do you say?
So you save the mother. You save the mother. And that's what Maimonides is trying to imply here as well. Not all cases of threats to the mother's life are clear-cut in terms of whether the fetus is triggering it or not triggering it, but the mother's life will indeed precede the life of the fetus. So, first I want to show you two sources, and as I said in the beginning, there are many more sources that could be brought on both sides of this issue. I'm just trying to bring some to give you a flavor of the discussion. So, we're going to bring two sources that argue that a fetus is considered to be a full life, before seeing sources that indicate otherwise. Source number 7. If a woman is having trouble giving birth, and this is the core text that Maimonides is building on in number 6. If a woman is having trouble giving birth, we cut the fetus in her womb and produce it limb by limb. I apologize, it's grotesque, but that's the case. Her life precedes. Once the majority of the fetus has emerged, we don't touch it. We do not push away one life for another. That's where Maimonides is getting what we saw in source number 6. But now, before we jump, we already deduced from here that in general you're not allowed to kill a fetus. Right? That we've seen. But there's another message here. There's another message. The fact that we say that you can only kill it because it's threatening the mother, but otherwise there's no justification, makes it sound like it is considered, in fact, a full life. That's what it makes it sound like to me. However, you could read this differently. What limitation could you see on saying a fetus is a full life from this text? Sorry?
That's if you can't get out of limb by limb.
Well, that's what you're going to have to do. You have to clean out the uterus.
But the fetus is not viable? Like, it doesn't count?
It's viable. The key message here is limited to the case in which the mother is in labor. Right? You're at the end of the pregnancy. Can you extrapolate from here? The fetus may be considered a full life after 9 months of gestation, but not necessarily after 3. Not necessarily earlier in the pregnancy. Don't extrapolate beyond your evidence. So your evidence here is a text that says that we consider this to be a full-blown life at the time of birth, but it didn't tell me anything about what its status is earlier. Very important point to remember. Flip the page now, please. Number 8. Another passage from the Talmud dealing with the case in which the mother dies on Shabbat with the fetus still inside her. If a woman is on the birthing table, she's trying to give birth, and she dies, and it is Shabbat. They bring a knife, tear open her belly, and produce the child. Right? They try to say they do what they can to save the child's life. That's the idea. Tell me something. You're violating Shabbat in order to do this. You're saving a... Wait, someone said? You're saving a life. But what does that teach me about how I view the fetus? That it is considered a life. Right, that's the implication. Otherwise, you would not be justified in violating Shabbat. However, you can make the argument here, once again, it sounds like you're on the birthing table. You're at the end of the pregnancy already. That's number 1. And number 2, it's a case in which the mother is already dead. And therefore, the fetus is no longer surviving off of the mother's systems. It's more independent. Earlier in the pregnancy, when the fetus is surviving only via what it's getting from the mother, maybe the argument should be it's considered less of a full life. So you can read these sources multiple ways. And that's they always used to tell me when I was in yeshiva that yeshiva guys end up making good lawyers. Whether that's true or not true, I can't say. But I will say that it's the type of thinking you have to bring to a source text to say, well, wait a minute, what are the limits here? What am I supposed to extrapolate, and where can you poke holes in an extrapolation? And you need to be able to do that, because you're going to have to resolve what seem to be conflicting sources. Go back, please, to source number 7, because we're not done with that one. The end of that source. It was also the last line in source number 6 from Maimonides. Either way, there is some slight difference. But look at number 7. Once the majority of the fetus has emerged, we don't touch it. We don't push away one life for another. That's an interesting statement. Once the head has emerged, I don't push away one life for another. Then what was it before the head emerged?
It wasn't born yet.
Not only was it not born, it wasn't the full life. Right? Otherwise, I should have made the same statement. You don't push off one life for another. Right? That's the argument that we could have made before. So the fact that we didn't say that before birth, that tells me, you know what? It's not actually called a life. You can make that argument. Another argument, this one from Silence. Take a look at source number 9, please. From the Mishnah, a core text, the core legal text of the Talmud. For a day-old child, tinok ben yomo, or ben yom achad, a day-old child, one who kills it is liable. That's a rule. But what does that tell me about a fetus? You're not liable in the same way. There's a difference in liability. So these are indirect, clearly. Both of these sources are indirect that I'm bringing, and you know that. And when you're dealing with indirect sources, you always have to be careful, again, that you don't overread what you have, that you don't go beyond your evidence. But the point that we're making here is that you have sources that seem to indicate that liability is not the same if you're dealing with a fetus. But we can get better than this. We can have direct sources that tell me that. Take a look at source number 10. This requires a little bit of background. A Kohen, right, the priestly family, receives something called truma. If I have Israeli produce, I'm obligated to separate a percentage of it, it's about 2%, and give it to the Kohen to eat. Not only does the Kohen eat it, the Kohen's whole family eats it. So if the Kohen marries a woman who is not from a family of Kohanim, she's able to eat this as well. Their children are able to eat it, and so on. Let's say a Kohen gets married to a woman who's not from a family of Kohanim. She's from the family of Yisrael, plain old Yisrael. So a Kohen marries someone from Yisrael. They have marriage of however many years, and then they split up. Or and then he dies. What's her status? Does she continue to eat the truma tithe? Or does she go back to her original status?
She's still his widow.
She is his widow. The answer is, as with all matters in Jewish law, it depends. Specifically, if she has children from the marriage, then she is still part of a family of Kohanim, and therefore she continues to eat truma. If she has no children from it, she goes back to, again, being part of Yisrael. That's the deciding factor. This is straightforward biblical law. This part of it is easy. The problem is this. Her husband died, or they got divorced, either way. It's the next day. They don't have any kids we know of, but she could be pregnant. So does she eat truma? Does she not eat truma? What's the rule? So take a look at source number 10. He's actually, I'm sorry, I read it the opposite way of the case here. The case here is the opposite, but it's the same concept. If a Kohen's daughter marries a non-Kohen, so she's not able to eat truma. She can't eat the tithe during the marriage and after the marriage if she has children from this non-Kohen. However, if her husband dies or they get divorced and then there are no children, then she goes back to being able to eat truma. So our question is that case. If a Kohen's daughter married a Yisrael, so she is from a family of Kohanim, she marries a non-Kohen who then died. So she can go to mikvah and eat truma already that night. She's going to mikvah because her husband just died. She was tameh. She was impure from contact with his dead with his corpse. And then she can go eat truma. Rav Chisda clarified, and this is our case. She may immerse and eat truma for 40 days. Meaning, she was married to a non-Kohen, but for the next 40 days, she's allowed to eat truma, even though she could be pregnant. Why? Since if she's not pregnant, then she's not pregnant, then there's no issue. And if she is pregnant, then the fetus is what's called in Aramaic, maya ba'alma, mere water, until 40 days have elapsed. In other words, whatever she's carrying for the first 40 days of her pregnancy is not considered to be a significant enough life such that we would say she's attached to this family of Yisraelim. How do they pick 40 days? Excellent question. Tell me, this is a good question. What's the answer? Where does 40 days come from? Nothing to do with the wilderness. Nothing to do with the flood. Sorry? Nope. Nope. The Catholic Church thinks it's about the gender of the child. The Catholic Church does this really funny thing, and there's a whole thing going back to Augustine about this, which is fascinating. There's a biblical rule regarding the period of separation of a husband and wife after birth, and how there is a difference depending on whether it's a boy or whether it's a girl, period of purity and impurity. And the Catholic Church somehow took that in the early days as a sign that during pregnancy, the male fetus gets a soul at one point, and the female fetus gets a soul at a different point. That wasn't one of ours, but they somehow drew that from ours. But that's neither here nor there for our purposes. This is not about that. What it seems to be about is actually something much more mundane, and that's it's about medicine. Meaning, if you were to look at an embryo at the 6-week mark, that's when you can start to differentiate certain structures which will mark it as being human. And yes, it's from the Talmud, but keep in mind, you had autopsies going on already. The Talmud describes autopsies. They were doing that. And so what they're talking about is, at the 6-week mark, the idea that you can start to identify it as being human. Lest one say, hang on. Lest one say, well, why were they looking at it? This actually mattered a great deal because there are all sorts of laws that surround cases of miscarriage. Rules of purity and impurity, rules of burial, rules of mourning. And so the Talmud includes quite a bit of literature on examining a miscarriage. What if something, you know, whatever reason, emerges early, and trying to figure out, is this considered to be significant enough such that it would trigger certain rules, such that it would trigger the laws that are associated with a miscarriage, or would we say, this is not so? And they went based on physical structure and what it looked like. Now, I believe I have someone with medical knowledge here.
Yeah.
No? No, not Stephen. No? Maybe. So I don't know. I know that I looked at the slides of what it looks like at different stages. I don't know whether you can look at a 6-weeker and say this is different. You know, this looks more human or in any way more developed.
The 25 millimeters long.
Right.
It'll have a heartbeat at six weeks.
That's human.
But you won't be able to. But you wouldn't be able to determine structures.
No.
See, my problem is I looked at slides, but I didn't check the magnification. I don't know what it was that I was looking. You don't think that at 6 weeks you'd be able to? So I have homework now, which is good. To go back and look at what I had seen, and include it on the email that I send out as the follow up from this class. So we will get more information on this point, Stephen.
There were no laws until Moshe had come down after 40 days.
Okay. That's not quite so, but that doesn't tie into... No, it's not 40 days on Mount Sinai. It's not about that, no.
I just have a question. I thought autopsies were not done in the Jewish, like, you know...
Right, so...
Pregnant bodies, so they would do it then? I'm not sure.
So the answer is there were cases of autopsy in order to do specific laws, and it's actually worth it to have a class on autopsy, because you're right, there's a lot of misinformation about autopsy. So at some point in the future, you'll see that advertised, and those who don't like things that are that morbid don't have to go. I think I did a class at one point on autopsy. Maybe I'll send out a link to a class on autopsy. Fine. Okay. In any case, that's one source that seems to say that at least up to 40 days, it's not considered a full-blown life, right? That's what we're extrapolating from this source. The other one that I wanted to show you here is source number 11, based on a verse in Genesis. Rabbi Yishmael, one of the sages of the Mishnah, a couple of thousand years ago, is cited as saying that a Noahide, a non-Jew, is liable even for killing a fetus. So the Talmud says, why? Why should a Noahide be liable for that? And they quote a biblical verse, which is from after the flood. One who spills the blood of man in man, comma, his blood will be spilled. The Hebrew speakers will appreciate this. The biblical text says the following. Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech. One who, it sounds like a palindrome. One who spills the blood of man, by man his blood shall be spilled. What it's meant to teach is the imposition of law, because what leads to the flood is people rampantly harming each other in pursuit of their own satisfaction. And so we're told, anyone who spills the blood of man, by man his blood shall be spilled. That's the first case of capital punishment. So what the Talmud is doing here is saying, read the sentence differently. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam. Comma, damo yishafech. One who spills the blood of man in man, his blood will be spilled. They're picking up on nuances in the wording of the sentence. It's a little bit of an anomalous text. And saying, maybe read it this way. What does that mean? The blood of man in man. What is that? The answer is, it's a fetus. From which we deduce that that not just Jews, but everybody would be liable for having killed a fetus. Now, yes?
Go back to the first page, which talks about if men fight and strike a pregnant woman, etc.
Yes.
And then there's no, capital punishment.
Yeah.
How is that different from what you
said? Good. Yeah. Excellent question. How do you resolve this when I have a biblical verse that says that the punishment is financial for having struck this woman and killed the fetus? So I want to come to that in one second, but I want to just finish this source in and of itself first in order to make the lesson of it clear. Because tell me something. Why did I need this verse in source number 11 when I already have source number 4? One who strikes an ish who then dies will be put to death. Why do I need a text specifically about a fetus? Elaine, you can answer, or are you asking a different question?
No, I'm going to, focus.
If it's a new question, then
I'll go on the next. Well, okay. I don't know if this is the answer, but this is specifically talking about a non-Jewish person.
Correct.
Killing a woman.
Correct. Pregnant. Correct. And that, in fact, is part of the response. Meaning, first of all, the statement is that this is actually not considered murder. This is, instead, feticide. In other words, there's murder that applies to people who are already out in the world. And separate from that, there is a prohibition against ending the life of a fetus, and it's not the same thing as murder, and will not follow the same rules as murder. And now, to go back and answer your question, it is indeed, as Elaine surmises, a distinction between the law for Jews and non-Jews. And the idea will be that it's actually stricter if a non-Jew does it than if a Jew does it. Which is mind-boggling, because that's not the way our religion normally works. But that's exactly what is being suggested here. And in fact, it is brought as a practical recommendation that in the event that one needs to have, this is going to, people are going to be really shocked by this, but the idea is that in the event that someone needs to have an abortion, which Jewish law allows, they should have a Jewish doctor do it.
Yeah.
It is better to have a Jewish doctor be the one to carry it out and not to have a non-Jew be the one to carry it out. That's actually a practical ruling that has been quoted in numerous circumstances.
This really troubles me because it seems that the fetus, the status of the fetus, changes depending who the exterior force is. I don't understand how the fetus's status changes so dramatically.
But it's not. The prohibition remains. The difference is the penalty we're going to give to the person who kills it.
But that's because one way is deemed a human being and the other it doesn't. That changes.
It's because one person has a prohibition against doing this that says this is murder, and the other one does not have that prohibition. It's considered an act of violence. I mean, we have that in other areas of law. It's just usually it goes the other way in terms of the Jew and the non-Jew. So there is a prohibition for me to eat treif, right? The pig is still the same. I'm not allowed to eat it. Someone who isn't Jewish is allowed to eat it. The thing is still the same. It's the distinction based on the actor as opposed to that which is acted upon. So what you have here is a mess. No, what you have is a set of conflicting sources. Where I have, just within the rabbinic sources, I have two sources that seem to say it's a full life. You're going to break Shabbat in order to save its life. You're going to break Shabbat in order to save its life. And we said that at the stage of labor, I'm not allowed to end its life unless it's threatening the life of the mother. On the other hand, I have two sources that are indirectly indicating that it's not a full life, because we say that once its head is out, you're not allowed to push it off for the mother, implying that before that, it is less than a full life. We said that there's a text that says that if you kill a day-old child, you are liable, implying that if it's not yet a day old, you're not, or not liable in the same way. And then we have the direct sources. Until 40 days, it's Maya Ba'alma, it's just water. And the idea also that you see here, that the non-Jew will be punished for killing a fetus because of this text that that we quote from Genesis, but that a Jew would not be under this prohibition. So in order to deal with this, and the fact that we know it's prohibited, we just don't understand how to square the circle in terms of these various sources, what we end up concluding is the following. Number one, it's clear that the fetus is not a full life. That's number one. Number two is it's clear that it's going to vary at different stages within the pregnancy. You saw that from the 40-day distinction and the statements that were made specifically at the time of birth. So what ends up being exactly the nature of this prohibition? What exactly is the prohibition against ending the life of a fetus? So there are a range of arguments. The most lenient argument is the one that I'm not even going into here, but I'll mention it, is someone mentioned in the beginning when I asked for biblical sources that relate to abortion, there's a mitzvah of procreating. So here you are preventing procreation. That's true, but it's fairly lightweight as prohibitions go. Failure to fulfill a commandment, while not a good thing, is also not severe enough to warrant any particular penalty. The next stage up, though, is the line that I quote you here in source number 12. They're talking about the status in Jewish law of a mitzvah which was taught before Sinai and was not repeated in the Torah after Sinai. So, for example, we have the mitzvah of circumcision. The mitzvah of circumcision is presented before Sinai, right? Abraham has a Brit Milah, Ishmael gets one, Isaac gets one. And then it's repeated in the Parsha of Tazria, where we're told that on the eighth day, you shall circumcise him. So they are repeated after Sinai. On the other hand, there is a mitzvah of not eating the Gid HaNasheh. The Gid HaNasheh, the sciatic neurovascular bundle. In a kosher animal, it's the part of the body where Jacob is struck when he fights with the angel, and we're told in that story, therefore we don't eat the Gid HaNasheh. But it's never repeated post-Sinai. Or you have the mitzvah we mentioned before, procreation, the mitzvah of having children. It's mentioned going way back to the beginning of the Torah, but post-Sinai we never get a reiteration of this commandment. So what's the status? Nope, never. So what's the status of a mitzvah that didn't get repeated to the Jews after Sinai? So the Talmud brings this line, any mitzvah conveyed to Noahites and not repeated at Sinai applies to Jews, not Noahites. You catch what it said? If the mitzvah was stated when we weren't yet Jewish and it was not reiterated after Sinai, then it's only for us. So the Talmud says, well, that's counterintuitive. I would have said just the opposite. If the mitzvah was stated before, then it's for all human beings. You never repeated it just for us. The Talmud asked it just the opposite. If it was not repeated at Sinai, then it's only for non-Jews. To which the Talmud says that can't be. Nothing is permitted for Jews and prohibited for non-Jews. There's no such thing. If they're not allowed to do it, we're not allowed to do it. Judaism doesn't make things easier for the person who becomes Jewish. It doesn't work that way. The Talmud just can't accept that idea. So the question is, if that's really what you're saying, and this idea is applied to abortion, because in source number 11 we said non-Jews are not allowed to perform an abortion, well, it must be that I wouldn't be allowed to also, because it can't be that they're not allowed to and I am allowed to. This principle, this statement of there can be nothing that is prohibited for them and permitted for us, can be read in multiple ways. One way to read that line is to say, so it must be prohibited somehow for us, I just don't know how. It's just a diagnostic principle, saying, well, it must be prohibited for us too. But the other way to look at this is that this is actually a rabbinic statement. And what the rabbis are teaching me, it's rabbinic, is the rabbinic statement is that in the event that something is off limits for non-Jews, even if there's no biblical prohibition for us, the rabbis will come along and say, but you're not allowed to do it. It's a rabbinic prohibition. So it's possible to make the argument, we're not going to stop with this, it's possible to make the argument that abortion is actually rabbinically prohibited for us. Just because it's prohibited for non-Jews, it can't be permitted for us, and therefore the rabbis came along and said, we don't want you to do it. It can't be that it's prohibited for them and permitted for us. And that's one argument that is made. Rabbi, yeah?
Then a rabbi, rabbinically, he could change the Ten Commandments.
What do you mean?
The Noahide laws, of which there are seven, they seem to be fixed. The Ten Commandments further enhance them.
Okay.
But with rabbinic law, they can come and change interpretation, therefore changing the law.
Well, what he's doing here, what the suggestion here is not so much changing as adding a prohibition. Okay. It's not changing what's on the books as much as adding a prohibition.
And an interpretation. Okay.
Yeah.
But different rabbis could make different decisions.
So when we talk about rabbinic law, and that really is its own topic, but what we're talking about now is enactments that go back 2,000 plus years and that were accepted by the rabbinical courts of the day and practiced by the population of the day. A rabbinic enactment that was not accepted fell away. So we have an example of that. There was a certain prohibition that was decreed regarding use of olive oil produced by non-Jews. It was part of an attempt to separate the Jewish community from the non-Jewish to say, if they produce the olive oil, you're not supposed to cook with it. And that prohibition never stuck. Likely because you need olive oil. It was too severe a prohibition. People could not handle it, and it didn't stay. But generally speaking, anything that survives as rabbinic legislation, once it's there, you're stuck with it. Once it is accepted, it's more complex than that. I'm oversimplifying a complicated topic, but the answer would be no. One doesn't get to repeal it. But in this case, it's less relevant because almost no one adopts the view that abortion is only rabbinically prohibited. The reason why I bring it is because if it were true, if that were the position we would adopt, that would open up all sorts of grounds for leniency. Because rabbinic law allows for a lot of leniency in cases of need, where biblical law is obviously more strict. Another argument that is made regarding abortion is to say, you know, you have all sorts of general rules within the Torah about human behavior, which don't specify particular actions, but give us ideals. Take a look at source number 13. Assuming that we set aside certain general ethical and religious norms, this is from Rabbi Aaron Lipkins. Assuming we set aside norms such as, you shall do that which is upright and good, you shall be holy, you shall follow in the ways of God, there would be, according to this view, no biblical prohibition to kill any fetus. I'm using this for the opposite point, the point that he's springing from, which is to say, you know, you have all sorts of value statements that are also laws within Judaism. We have an imperative to be holy. We have an imperative to do that which is upright and good. We have an imperative to follow in the ways of God. And ending the life of a fetus may fly in the face of that. And again, that's going to be circumstantial. That's going to depend on your case. But his argument is maybe those ought to be brought to bear as biblical principles in the case at hand. Maybe. However, the more dominant view is that abortion is what you see in source number 14 in Jewish law. This here, the next two views that we're going to see are the more dominant views. Rabbi Yosef ben Moshe Trani is one of many authors to float this idea. I brought his formulation because it was concise. He quotes you a source from Tosfot. Tosfot is a set of commentaries. It's an anthology of commentaries on the Talmud going back to the 12th and 13th centuries. So Tosfot wrote, although he is exempt regarding the abortion, he talks about a case in which one is not liable for having conducted an abortion, it is still not permitted. And he comments on that and says, why? Because it is an act of wounding. It's not murder. It's wounding. Of course, that leads to a big question. Right? What's the big question?
Does it save a life?
No, more fundamental question. Who are you wounding? Who are you wounding? Is this about wounding the fetus? Or is it about wounding the mother? Practical ramification of that question. What if it's to save the mother's health? And I'm not talking about the dire case where she can't give birth and she's bleeding and we're worried that she might die. What about a case of severe psychological harm to the mother? Which might justify wounding in order to prevent that kind of psychological harm, right? The classic rape and incest victim questions. The questions for a woman who had a history of postpartum depression, severe depression, and now she is pregnant. Maybe if the issue really is wounding, then there's a justification to say, we'd rather have this wound than have the alternatives. So this becomes a major question. Or we talk about wounding the fetus, in which case it's not up to the mother to say, well, I'm willing to suffer this wound in order to avoid other problems, because it's not about her. It's about the wounding of the fetus. All he said is wounding. So that's something we still have to visit clearly next week. But that's one major view that is accepted regarding abortion, is that what we're talking about is wounding, and that will explain the text we started with, which said that the penalty is not death. The penalty is payment. Why? Because that's what happens when you wound somebody. The penalty indeed is financial. However, not everybody takes that view. Source number 15, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and many others say no. He says it is even more clear in the Rambam, in Maimonides, that killing a fetus is murder. Why? Because go back to that source that we saw in number 7. It was number, Maimonides brought it in number 6. Either way is fine. We talked about the case of saving the life of the mother by killing the fetus, right? The justification for doing that was the fetus is pursuing the life of the mother. Implying what? Implying that this is a full-blown life. The only reason I'm allowed to end his life is because he's the aggressor against the mother. In the same way that if I were walking down the street and I saw person A running after person B to kill him, and I had a way to stop the pursuer, so I kill the pursuer. That's the justification here. So Rabbi Feinstein says, if that's what it takes to justify the abortion, that must mean that this fetus is considered a full-blown life. And the only justification is where it is a pursuer. Now, keep in mind, the source he's quoting is only at the end of the pregnancy. We still have to ask, what about after 40 days? And not only that, we're going to see next week other stages within the pregnancy that matter when you're dealing with practical cases. So what we've seen so far, and we got through a fair amount of the topic. I didn't delude myself into thinking this was a 60-minute topic. I did the best I could. But What I hope we have so far out of all of this is, first of all, the basic mechanism for approaching these issues. We start with biblical text, We look at the rabbinic discussions and the sources which may argue one way or the other. We try to see if there are nuances, like the question of, is this talking about a Jew? Is this talking about a non-Jew? Is this talking about earlier in the pregnancy, later in the pregnancy? And you try to figure out from all of that how to come up with a legal theory that supports the cases at hand, that can fit the evidence we have. As I said in the beginning, I cut out a lot of material in order to be able to present this. What I want to do next week, before we start on the cosmetic surgery discussion, is talk about the nuances of the cases that we're looking at, and the question is, how do you apply this? And the two cases I want to apply it to are the Tay-Sachs diagnosis and the case of abortion for the sake of the mother's emotional health. So, God willing, that will be the topic next week. And in the event that anyone still needs to do registration, especially get on the email list if anyone wants to pay, please see me. Thank you very much.